From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In your summer outdoor adventures, you may be given a scare by the object of Harry Green's affection, snakes. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with herpetologist Harry Green about the mating rituals of rattlers, how snakes inject their venom, and how they manage to swallow whole animals much wider than they are. Green studies snakes around the world and is the author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. Also today, jazz singer Helen Merrill remembers her collaborations with arranger Gil Evans. She has a new album. And David Bianculli reviews Basketball, the new film by the makers of the animated series South Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hundreds of police officers are again lining the streets for the funeral of a Capitol Hill police officer. Officer Jacob Chestnut will be buried in Arlington National Cemetery today. Color guards lined up outside the suburban Maryland church where Chestnut's funeral was held. The officers were joined by 26 bagpipers from the Chicago Police Department. Chestnut was shot to death last Friday along with Agent John Gibson in the Capitol building. The man held in connection with their slayings has not been released from the hospital. General Motors began reopening assembly plants today. This follows two lengthy strikes at a pair of GM parts plants in Flint, Michigan. Analysts say that within a week, the automaker's North American operations could be running at near normal levels. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
With the Flint workers back on the job, the supply lines from parts plant to assembly line are slowly filling up. GM is taking two major things into account when determining the order in which idle plants will come back online. Those that build the most in-demand products will be given top priority. Geography is also an issue. The closer a plant is to Flint, the more likely it will reopen sooner. The first plants to begin assembling vehicles include a truck plant in Janesville, Wisconsin, two car plants in Lansing, Michigan, and a Cadillac plant in Hamtramck, Michigan. On Monday, another 15 plants could be running again, including factories in Oshawa, Ontario, and Pontiac, Michigan, which are building a brand new full-size pickup truck that dealers are anxious to begin selling. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
Three Roman Catholic nuns murdered by a suspected Muslim extremist in the country of Yemen have been buried in a Christian cemetery in the southern Yemeni city of Aden. Yemeni officials, diplomats, and some Muslim Yemeni citizens participated in the funeral service. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
The bodies of a Filipina and two Indian nuns from Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity order were quietly laid to rest. Yemeni police stood guard at the church and were posted along the funeral route. Security officials said they sought to ensure a very safe service out of respect for other religions. The three nuns were shot dead on Monday on their way to work at the order's clinic by a suspected Muslim militant in Hodeidah, about 140 miles from the capital, Sana'a. The 22-year-old assailant was described as having psychological problems. He said he killed the nuns because they were preaching Christianity. Pope John Paul has expressed his deep sadness over their murder to Sister Nirmila and has said prayers for the slain nuns. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 23 points to 9,003 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq is off 10 points at 1909. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, investors got their biggest economic number of the week today in the form of the gross domestic product for the second quarter of this year. While not as bad as expected, the market apparently is not impressed. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The news that GDP during the second quarter grew at just a 1.4% annual rate, far below the 5.5% rate the economy expanded during the first 3 months of the year, has caused a bit of investor nervousness on Wall Street today. That is because, despite the fact growth was not flat or even negative, as some had feared, there's the question of what slower growth will mean for corporate earnings. GDP is a measure of goods and services moving through the economy. Cereal maker Kellogg announced today its second quarter earnings were down 17% and warned of further earnings declines as it continues to lose sales to rivals including Quaker Oats. Stock in Procter & Gamble is also lower despite a rise in second quarter earnings. The company's profits failed to meet Wall Street expectations. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Beer maker Anheuser-Busch could be facing a strike. Teamsters leaders are meeting in St. Louis to decide whether to call such a job action against the country's largest brewer. Union workers yesterday rejected a 5-year contract offer. The sticking point here is job security rather than wages. Workers object to a proposed cut of premium weekend pay, but also object to a company demand to hire seasonal workers and changes that the union says would create part-time jobs rather than full-time jobs. Computer industry companies are cutting back. Hewlett-Packard is cutting the pay of managers. National Semiconductor says it's asked its 13,000 employees to take 10 days off without pay. Both companies are still grappling with the effects of the financial crisis in Asia. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the creatures you probably fear most, the creature you're afraid you might run into if you're planning any outdoor explorations this summer, is the creature my guest is obsessed with, the snake. There are 2,700 species of snakes. Harry Green is particularly interested in the venomous ones. He travels around the world studying the behavior of serpents. He's done field work in Europe, Africa, Latin America, the West Indies, and the United States. He's curator of herpetology in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's the author of the book Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. On this archive edition, we have an interview we recorded last summer. Just before we turned the tape on, Green asked me what I thought of snakes. A logical question for him to ask, I thought. But next he asked me what I thought of spiders. I couldn't figure out why he wanted to know.
I ask you about the spiders because it turns out to be the case that a fair number of people who like snakes are arachnophobic. They're afraid of spiders, at least mildly so.
People who probably like snakes are afraid of spiders?
The most famous person is probably E.O. Wilson, whom you've probably talked to before.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, he admits to being mildly arachnophobic, and I am also, and I have no idea why these two things are coupled.
Wait, you're afraid of spiders?
I'm uneasy about them, and I don't like being surprised by them.
Even ones that aren't poisonous?
Well, I think all spiders are venomous in a sense that they, you know, they have these little fangs and venom and so forth. It's just that only some of them affect people. But yes, even the ones that aren't dangerous to people give me the willies.
That's really interesting because so many people get the willies from snakes, and you love snakes.
That's right. I would handle large venomous snakes all day long before I'd pick up a tarantula.
Huh? What is it that could you figure it out?
I have no idea. It's very strange because I've never been afraid of snakes since I was a small child, and I've always been uneasy about spiders.
Huh.
You know, we know that the whole thing about snakes is very complicated, that it's likely that people have sort of a learning bias, an innate learning bias to be afraid of snakes. And yet, that bias can be easily reversed or reinforced by early experience with your parents, your classmates, and so forth. And perhaps spiders are the same way. Maybe something happened to me when I was a little kid. Maybe my mother was afraid of spiders or something, and I grew up not having any fear of snakes reinforced, but having a fear of spiders reinforced.
Now, I know you're particularly interested in venomous snakes, so before we get any further, let me hit you with the question that I'm sure everyone wants to hear, which is, have you been bitten?
Ah, that's an embarrassing question because I wish I could say I'd never been bitten, but I was bitten once by a not very big copperhead when I was a teenager, and it was not a serious bite. I was measuring the copperhead in my garage laboratory. I was 17 years old, and I was watching the tail tip next to the yardstick more carefully than I was watching the head. And the snake managed to get one fang out the side of its mouth and poked me in the thumb.
What's the most dangerous snake that you've handled?
The most dangerous snake I've handled is called a terciopelo in Costa Rica. A lot of people know it as a fertilance. It's a very large pit viper. Reaches a length of maybe 7 feet or more, and has very long fangs, very powerful venom, fairly prone to bite.
And what do you do when you handle it? What's the best way to handle it?
Well, actually, I should tell you, I try I've tried to get away from actually handling venomous snakes. When I started out in herpetology, it was common to handle venomous snakes by holding their head down with a metal hook and then picking them up carefully between your finger and your thumb. And when I started going to meetings of herpetologists, people that study reptiles and amphibians, it was not uncommon to encounter something we called the herpetologist handshake, which was a missing finger or a finger that looked like it had been in a pencil sharpener or even a large mass of scar tissue in the palm. And that's not very common now, and I think the main reason is that we've tried to get away from that. And I've picked up many venomous snakes with my bare hands before, and I try to not do it anymore. The way we do it is to use a plexiglass tube that's a little bit larger in diameter than the snake, and then with our snake hook, we coax the venomous snake to crawl partway up into the plexiglass tube so it's essentially muzzled. And then you can just pick it up right where the snake goes into the tube and hold it so it can't move forward or backward. Can you sort of visualize what
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's great because it doesn't traumatize the snakes as much. It turned out that this mashing of the head down on the ground with enough force that you could safely restrain the snakes, probably pretty hard on the animal. And they really freak out. They start thrashing around trying to break free and trying to bite. And if you run them up this plexiglass tube, they obviously feel restrained and usually struggle a little bit, but they don't just start flipping about and thrashing and trying to bite. So it's both more humane and much safer for us.
Now, why do you need to handle snakes?
Well, I study snakes, and I teach about snakes. So the way I study snakes mainly is to surgically implant tiny radios in them such that I can find the snake over and over again and then sit down and observe its behavior. So in order to do the surgical implantation, first I have to catch the snake, and then I have to anesthetize it. And we use the same vapor that works well in people. We just run them up in the plexiglass tube like I just described and then squirt halothane or isoflurane vapors, which are the common anesthetics for people, into the other end of the tube. In about 10 minutes, the snake is in deep surgical anesthesia, and we can make a little incision in the side and put a tiny little radio in the animal's body cavity, and put a few sutures in, and let it back out into the wild, and then watch it for a couple of years.
So you can pick up transmissions and know where the snake is and then follow
exactly.
The snake and its behavior.
That's right. When I was a kid, or when I was a student, a college student, I wanted to be a biologist, and my hero above all was a guy named George Schaller. Maybe you've met George also. He's sort of famous for studying pandas and mountain sheep and so on. And the reason I idolized him was not because he worked with these big stinky mammals, but because he could watch individual. Yeah, he could watch individual animals.
Oh, you prefer snakes, huh?
Oh, very much, very much. And he could watch them for long periods of time throughout their lives. And I thought that was going to be impossible with snakes because it was hard enough to find a snake once, but to find the same snake over and over again, say for a period of 5 or 6 years, which I've now done with some black-tailed rattlesnakes, just seemed impossible. And the miniaturization of radio telemetry has made that possible. It's a technological trick that's just revolutionized the study of snakes.
So what are some of the things that you can learn now because you can follow one snake over the course of 5 years or more?
Well, there are a lot of things that you might expect. They're sort of routine, like how do they find their mates and how do they hunt and how do males react to each other in the presence of a mating female and so forth. And so I could tell you about the details of that. But in fact, for me, the most spectacular thing, and I think the thing that's had the most impact on my own attitudes as a person and as a biologist, have been watching individual animals and getting this very strong sense that they're idiosyncratic, that they have individual personalities, and that they have a very detailed knowledge of their surroundings, which they gain through experience and use in the course of being successful hunters and so forth.
Tell us about the personality of one snake that you followed over years.
Okay. Well, in Arizona, I've watched a total of about 26 black-tailed rattlesnakes now for the last 8 years, and some of them I've watched for as much as 6 years. And each of these animals has a very well-defined home range that it uses over and over again and uses exact travel routes. And this home range would be sort of an elliptical or oval portion of a canyon, maybe half a mile long. And in the course of an active season from April through October, a large male, which would be about a yard long, might travel this oval 2 or 3, 4 times, sometimes in just one day while either looking for wood rats to eat or looking for females with which to mate. And the kinds of differences we see among individuals, for example, are that most of these snakes eat wood rats. And you might have heard of these as pack rats. These are these rats that are pretty common in the southwestern U.S. that make a big nest out of sticks and trash and cactus pads and so forth. And the snakes hunt by positioning themselves perpendicular to the rat's runways. And so the rat comes bopping along and doesn't see the snake and then gets bitten and eaten. Well, of 26 snakes now, 25 of them basically hunt like that. One of them, female number 12, has got a thing for chipmunks. And she hunts by positioning herself perpendicular at the base of big trees and sometimes up in trees. And she's the only individual among these 26 black-tailed rattlesnakes that we've observed hunting like that. And yet she does it repeatedly. And of course, I have no idea yet what the origin of this difference is among individuals, whether she, you know, a chance activity caused her to become a chipmunk hunter or whether she has some genetic predispositions for that difference.
And does it make you feel good to know that individual snakes have their own eccentricities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a survey recently of people who are professional animal behaviorists, and it turned out that many of us, if really pressed, say that a real defining motivation for doing what we do is that we wonder what it's like to be a particular organism. So some people wonder what it's like to be a lion. Some people wonder what it's like to be a duck. And I wonder what it's like to be a snake. And I think one reason I find that very satisfying is because it's such a challenge. Snakes are so mysterious. They don't have these eyelids and facial features with which we easily identify.
They don't have legs. I mean, that.
Yeah.
There's so little as a human that you can identify with as a snake.
That's right.
There's so little in the way of similarities.
That's right. They seem inscrutable at first.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching these individuals, and I often just sit for fairly long periods of time with binoculars maybe 10 or 15 feet away from a snake while it's hunting or courting or mating or whatever, and I just watch them. And I've watched the same individuals for weeks on end, year after year. And I have this very strong feeling of things like intentionality and so forth on the part of the snakes.
It's funny, you know, as a herpetologist, you probably dream about snakes. You're interested in them. You work with them. But if I were a Freudian analyst, I'd say it was just all phallic.
Right.
Did that ever happen to you, that people kind of misread this kind of symbolism onto your interest in snakes?
Certainly. Certainly. Or they just think it's goofy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But I actually, insofar as I can understand this, I've thought some about why, and especially why venomous snakes.
Yeah.
And that's actually how my book started. In 1983, through an editor at the University of Chicago Press, I met Norman McLean, the man who wrote A River Runs Through It.
Mm-hmm.
And I had admired Norman's book a lot. And when I met him, I was wanting to write about things other than science. And I thought by talking to Norman, I could figure out how to write something. And instead, he just kept saying, "Why do you want to work with those rattlesnakes? Why don't you go write about that?" And at the time, wasn't really able to come to grips with the question.
Mm-hmm.
My book has like a smaller book running through it of essays at the start of each chapter, which are explore this and lead to an epilogue that's my answer to Norman's question. And in a very short version, it's that I think venomous snakes are icons for violence and life and death kinds of issues without having any evil or malevolence. You know, they're lacking in those anthropocentric things. And so you can contemplate life and death kinds of things without there being these human connotations.
That's interesting, right? They can kill you, but they're out for revenge or they want to hurt you. It's just their instinct. It's just how they eat
that's
and survive.
Right. They're trying to defend themselves, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or they kill the rat because that's no different than you going to the grocery store and picking out a side of beef or something. You know, the mechanism is a little different.
My guest is herpetologist Harry Green. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with Harry Green, the author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. You are particularly interested in venomous snakes. Why do snakes have venom?
Well, what we know is that snakes use venom for various things. Probably all venomous snakes are using their venom to subdue prey. And maybe you know that snakes have this capacity to just eat enormous meals. And in the case of venomous snakes, they can eat meals up to about 1.5 times their body weight. So here I am, 170-pound male, think in terms of me being able to eat a 210, 215-pound hamburger in 20 minutes without chopping it into pieces. Now, they can only do that because they can subdue that meal. You know, I couldn't subdue a 220-pound cow and then swallow it whole, you know, without knife, fork, implements, and so on. So the first thing venom does probably is it lets them subdue things. The other probably really important role it often plays is to help them digest things. So when this rattlesnake is sitting next to a rat runway and the rat comes by and the snake out of hiding strikes it for just an instant, and with these hypodermic needle-like fangs injects this venom into the rat and then lets go, the rat goes bounding off. And as the rat goes bounding down the side of the canyon, its own heartbeats are circulating the digestive enzymes that are in the snake's venom. In the meantime, the snake starts crawling along, tracking the rat, following its chemical trail. And the snake can distinguish between the trail of a bitten rat and an unbitten rat. Within a few minutes, it locates the rat, which is by now dead and by now is already being digested from the inside out. So those are probably the two main roles, are to subdue really big prey and to help digest this really big item that's soon going to be stuck in their stomach. Of course, there's an obvious third use, which is that many venomous snakes defend themselves with their venom.
You've probably spent a lot of time watching snakes eat their prey.
Yep.
How long does it take for the rodent that the snake has ingested whole to stop being a big bulge in the body of the snake?
You can watch it go down day by day, but say it was a snake that ate something approaching its own body weight, it might take it in the wild something like a week to 10 days to digest it. In fact, once with my radios, I found a female blacktail rattlesnake in the fall when it was quite chilly. I walked up to her with my antenna and my receiver and locator, and she had eaten what I think was a brush rabbit that probably weighed more than she did and was so big that she couldn't coil, and I don't think she could move. And so, of course, I become somewhat attached to these animals, having captured them and anesthetized them and put a radio in them. So my first thought was, oh, no, she's going to explode. It's cold and, you know, and we have a lot of predators at our study site. Maybe one's going to catch her. But each day I would come out and relocate her, and each day the bulge would be a little smaller. And after 9 days, she crawled up the canyon, went into hibernation, having eaten what was maybe a third of her energy budget for the whole year in this one feeding event.
When you wonder what it's like to be a snake, do you wonder what it's like to have this big thing in the middle of your body after you've eaten?
That's an interesting question, because I've tried to imagine various things about being a snake, and that's one I haven't had much success sort of thinking up a metaphor or an analog for. I know that if I overeat, I don't feel comfortable, but I never eat anything remotely close to even 20 or 30% of my body weight at one meal. So that's actually, I've tried to imagine what it's like to slither, and mm-hmm. I can't come very close to that. I've tried to imagine what it would be like to literally walk my head over an object bigger than me and have my whole stomach stretched around it, and I can't empathize with that very well. I've tried to think about what it would like to be to live in a chemical realm. In other words, if somehow smell for us could have the texture and nuance that vision does, what would that be like?
Is that the realm the snake lives in?
That's pretty much the realm a snake lives in. They have eyes and they can see, but there's just no question that chemosensation, which is what that forked tongue is for, is preeminent in the lives of most snakes. And the closest I've come, I've tried to imagine odor experiences for humans where it has subliminal effects on us, you know, where it has effects that we don't even think about. And one of them would be like, have you ever been driving down the highway and you happen to pass by a bakery?
Yeah.
And so suddenly it comes in your car window, the smell of fresh baked bread or yeast rolls. And, you know, you just almost before you think about it, you just start imagining right out of the oven yeast rolls with butter on them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in the direction of what it would be like to be a snake. Probably a more powerful example would be if you've ever noticed the odors you can smell in a landscape that you like after it rains.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, that's a very hopeful, happy feeling to be driving along in the Sonoran Desert, for example, and smell the creosote odors and so forth right after rain. I think before I consciously think about what does that mean, I'm already feeling sort of exhilarated and optimistic because of it. And I think that being a snake must be like that in the chemical world, except a lot more.
You know, the snake is such a powerful symbol, dating back to the Bible and, mm-hmm. and the Garden of Eden. What do you think it is about snakes that arouses such strong reactions?
I have an idea about that, and I write about this some in the book. I think the most interesting puzzle about this is that we have both an attraction and an aversion. And I think the reason is understandable. It was understandable to me once I realized that I found accounts of every major group of primates both eating snakes and being eaten by snakes. So I found a picture of a tarsier, this weird little alien-looking primate from the Philippines that has the sticky toe pads and the giant eyes. I found a picture of a tarsier eating a very dangerous cobra relative in Borneo. And yet I've also found records of snakes eating all the major groups of primates. So my hunch is that since long before we were people, in fact, long before we were apes, humans and our forebears have been confronting snakes both as a pretty good meal and also as a very dangerous thing to step on or pick up. And so there's a certain, there's an ambiguity and ambivalence to our relationships there. Plus, snakes symbolize all kinds of things, including probably sexual things like you mentioned earlier.
Harry Green is the author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. He's curator of herpetology at the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about snakes. TV critic David Bianculli reviews Basketball, the new film by the makers of the cable series South Park. And we talk with singer Helen Merrill.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips. I'll never use them. Take my arms, but don't abuse them. Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I go on without you? You took the part that one time was mine. Why not take all of me?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Harry Green. He's traveled around the world studying the behavior of snakes. He's the curator of herpetology in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. And he's the author of the book Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. Why do rattlers rattle?
To scare people away, to scare adversaries away. And that's virtually the only reason. The rattle doesn't rattle. They don't rattle, for example, when they're trying to catch prey or when they're courting, times like that. In fact, the only time I ever hear the rattle, other than when the snake is upset, is that the courtship involves the male sort of poking around the female's tail with his tail. And often for the first several hours and even several days of a courtship encounter, the female kind of keeps the male at bay. He follows her around just for hours and rubs her back and tongue flicks her back and so forth. And every few minutes he tries to lift her tail with his so he can mate with her. And at that stage, she slaps him away with her tail, and it makes a clanking sound to the rattles, not a loud buzzing like you get when they're defending themselves. So sometimes when I'm sitting and watching a courting pair and they disappear in the vegetation, I can't see them well, I'll know exactly what stage the courtship is at when I hear this clack, 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 and I know that she's just slapped him away and the whole thing's starting over.
Hmm. And how dangerous is the rattlesnake's bite?
Well, you know, it turns out we don't have real good statistics on snake bite in this country. Probably many snake bites, perhaps even some snake bite deaths, go unreported, but people have guessed in the neighborhood of 2,000 bites a year from all venomous snakes in this country, and maybe 10 deaths a year in the whole United States. And it turns out we know now pretty much what causes death. So if you actually were to die from rattlesnake bite, it would probably be because you went into shock from having your blood circulatory system damaged. And that's preventable in a hospital situation. So the bottom line is that basically you shouldn't die from a snake bite in this country with proper medical care.
If you had a friend who was bit by a snake, would you try to make an incision and suck out the venom like we see in old cowboy movies?
Well, I wouldn't make an incision. I don't think anybody recommends that anymore for a couple of reasons. One is we were always recommending that people stay calm, and I don't know why we didn't stop to think that you're not very likely to be calm if somebody's whacking away at your finger with a dull Swiss Army knife. You know, I mean, that's sort of guaranteed to make you not calm. And the other thing is there's a fairly serious danger that you would cut a nerve or a tendon or a blood vessel and actually cause something much more serious than the snake bite in terms of permanent injury. There are snake bite kits that act as suction devices, and there's a possibility that they do some good. So physicians I've worked with do recommend using those suction devices if they're conveniently available immediately. But the most important thing is just to keep the victim calm and get them to a medical facility.
You explained before that part of what the snake venom does to the snake's prey is predigest it.
Mm-hmm.
So like a mouse, for instance, would start getting digested from the inside out before the snake has even had a chance to swallow it.
That's right.
Do humans get predigested by snake venom when they're bit?
That's right. So if you were to get bitten by a good-sized rattlesnake in the hand, within a couple of hours, probably your whole forearm would be swollen. Certainly by the next day, your entire arm would be twice its normal diameter. So actually, it's pretty gross. I mean, if you got bitten by a big viper, within a day or two, your arm or hand would basically look like it had been barbecued.
What's it like for you to study snakes in the rainforest as opposed to, you know, say, in the mountains or something? I mean, the snakes there are surrounded by so much wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, tropical rainforests in general have the richest faunas and floras on Earth, and it's a general trend that if you go from temperate regions to the tropics, you get more species in the tropics. So in California, for example, I know a few places where you might find 15 species of snakes in one small area, but I worked in and the whole state only has about 30 species of snakes, and that's quite a lot. California's a big, complicated snake state with lots of elevation, lots of different botanical regions and so forth. And we have about 30 snakes species in the whole state. I worked in a place in Costa Rica, a 5-square-mile reserve that had about 60 species of snakes in relatively homogeneous rainforest. So you really pack lots of species into a small area. The place I just returned from in Vietnam has the richest snake fauna in the world, about 100 species in one small isolated mountain range. So when you walk in that kind of forest, it's almost claustrophobic from the biological diversity. I mean, you're just surrounded with it. Now, in terms of its effect on me, I actually like working in deserts better.
Why?
I really enjoy the rich biodiversity of tropical forests, but I find them a little bit claustrophobic, and I like working in a dry, hot environment where I can see long distances. I just find it emotionally more satisfying to look out over these big open landscapes.
There's a lot of species of snakes that are endangered. Snakes aren't kind of cute and cuddly, so it's easier probably to not care.
That's right.
About the snakes. I'm sure you run up against that a lot. Tell us why you care about snakes that are endangered and why you think we should care as well.
Well, of course, you know, for me, I actually like snakes, and so, of course, for selfish reasons, I'd like to see the world continue to contain snakes. You know, I could justify wanting to keep snakes around from a practical point of view in that when you look out at nature, all of nature is just a big experiment. There are all these plants and animals out there trying to solve the problem of making a living and surviving. And when you consider the literally hundreds of thousands of species trying to do this, we've essentially got unlimited solutions to all kinds of problems out there. The easiest way to sort of give an example of this value of biodiversity is to think about flight. So if I could just take you away from snakes for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask yourself if Leonardo would have ever looked up in the sky and wondered if we could fly if there weren't birds or insects. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that he would have just spontaneously started wiggling his arms and said, huh, I wonder if we do this fast enough or stick something broad enough on them, we can get up there into the sky. So I think that nature is just basically a vast, vast pool of inspiration, both aesthetically and practically. And snakes are part of that vast pool of inspiration. Not everyone's going to be inspired by them like I am, but many people are. And beyond the sort of aesthetic, emotional inspiration, there are all these possibilities for problem solving. And I'd take you back there to components in snake venom that turn out to be good anticoagulants and components in frog skin that turn out to be good morphine mimics and things like that.
Harry Green, he's the author of Snakes, The Evolution of Mystery in Nature. Our interview was recorded last summer. Coming up from the archives, an interview with singer Helen Merrill. This is Fresh Air. Jazz singer Helen Merrill has a new CD called You and the Night and the Music. On this archive edition, we're going to listen back to an interview with her. First, let's hear a track from the new CD. This is Beautiful Love.
Beautiful love, you're all a mystery. Beautiful love, what have you done to me? I was contented till you came along, filling my soul with your song. Beautiful love, I've roamed your paradise, searching for love, my dream to realize. for love will my dream come true.
One of the recordings Helen Merrill made early in her career, about 40 years ago, featured arrangements by Gil Evans. This was before Evans became known for his collaborations with Miles Davis on now classic albums like Miles Ahead, Porgy and Bess, and Sketches of Spain. Shortly before Evans' death in 1988, he and Merrill went back to the studio to re-record the material from their earlier record. The new versions were featured on the CD Collaborations, which had just been released when I spoke with Helen Merrill. Let's hear a track from that CD. This is I'm Just a Lucky So-and-So.
As I walk down the street, seems everyone I meet gives me a friendly hello. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so. The birds in every tree all seem so neighborly. They sing wherever I go. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so.
In 1988, I asked Helen Merrill how she and Gil Evans made the decision to re-record the old material.
He wanted to make a new record with me, and he was very enthusiastic and so on. But unfortunately, Gil's health was declining somewhat. He was having a problem with his eyes, and it was difficult for him to write. So we then thought of doing the old music over again, which is never really old. It's a form of classical music, as far as I'm concerned.
I'd like to try something. Can we compare a song from the two records and see how they sound in the older version and the new version?
Sure.
Great. Why don't we start with the new record? And this is your new recording with arrangements by Gil Evans of I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
Listening back to that, what do you think you did differently than in the first version?
Well, in the first place, it's a half tone lower. <That's>,
okay.
And in the second, I do a song differently every time I sing it. And it's a different feeling. I've been a fool many times over since then, so I'd have a different view of being a fool, and I suspect it's reflected in my version.
You know, I just have to tell you, before we hear the first version of it, that I love the way you space in your phrasing, I'm a fool to want you. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I think of lyrics as a way of portraying what we are feeling inside, and the words just sort of punctuate those feelings.
Okay, let's go back a little over 30 years and listen to your first recording of that.
Okay.
With Gil Evans' arrangements. And this is Helen Merrill singing I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
What do you think about hearing that back now?
I think I did pretty well 30 years ago with the phrasing, and the music was certainly different. The key makes it sound quite different. The new record is a lot darker.
Yes, it is. That's right.
Yes, and Gil's conducting of the orchestra was entirely different. I think he was feeling differently, too, about music when we did the second record.
Would you explain what you mean by that?
Well, he was kind of feeling, I think, a little sadder than he did when we did the record 30 years ago. We had many conversations. He was very insulted by old age, and he was very frustrated by the inability of his body to respond to his brain. You know, the problems with his eyes, and he just was insulted by old age, and his head was certainly not there. And so I think that was reflected in the way he performed the music.
The one new song that you recorded for the new record.
Ah, I like that one.
It's called Summertime.
Yeah.
It's called Summertime. Well, we all know Summertime. Why did you choose Summertime as the one extra song?
Because I like it.
Uh-huh. It's a very striking interpretation.
Thank you. That's a wonderful jazz vehicle. And I knew that it would be something that I would enjoy doing with Gil. As simple as that.
I think it's a hard song to make fresh since so many people have sung it already.
That's the beauty of jazz, though. You know, I think you can make everything fresh. I mean, there are so many ways to look at the emotions of those lyrics. I have sung it very angrily. I've sung it hopelessly and helplessly. I've sung it through the mind of the Universal Mother. You know, it's not at all a boring emotion. It's a very, very deep one that's going to exist forever. So it can't be boring. And as far as the music is concerned, that certainly is not. So, no, I don't think that you can do that song enough too many times.
Summertime. It's easy. Fish are jumping, the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich, your mother's...
Your mother was a Seventh-day Adventist, right?
That's right.
When you started singing in clubs, did she oppose that?
My mother was not around to see that, but I can assure you she would have more than opposed it, yes.
She would have tried to prevent it.
Oh, no doubt about that, yeah.
So did you feel at all guilty about that?
I compensated.
How so?
Well, I was very shy, and I remained to myself pretty much, and I didn't put on too much perfume or lipstick on stage. Didn't go to too many dances until...
Didn't wear low-cut gowns?
No, definitely not. In fact, I used to forget to change my shoes sometime to go on stage. And one time, Dinah Washington caught me. She said, Helen, come back here. I have to talk to you. And you can't go on stage with shoes like that.
What were you wearing?
My Oxfords with an evening gown on. So, no, I wasn't too into what one was supposed to be into. You know, trying to be a star, but it was a lot to do with being Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah, it really did.
You spent most of the 60s and 70s abroad, first living in Italy and then living in Japan. Why did you leave the United States?
Well, at that time, the only work available to me, and again, perhaps this is where the religion sort of came into it, but the only work available was a rotten, lousy, dirty jazz clubs and places I wouldn't go to visit if I... You know, I just wouldn't even step inside them. And it was degrading to work in places like that. And furthermore, there was no money. Mostly people would drink and make a lot of noise. And it was just not dignified. A lot of us left the country at that time. And I found, to my surprise, that I did a lot of television shows. I did things that I certainly didn't do at home.
When you came back to the United States sometime in the 70s, was it hard for you to re-enter the jazz scene which you were so anxious to leave before?
It wasn't the jazz scene that I was leaving, and I wouldn't want to re-enter that scene. that I left, I still don't want that scene. That hasn't changed. It is, re-enter the world of music, the business of music, like recording and so on. Yes, it was difficult.
Helen Merrill recorded in 1988. Her 1988 CD with Gil Evans, Collaboration, is still in print. Her new CD is called You and the Night and the Music. Coming up, Basketball. This is Fresh Air. Basketball, a new film comedy opening today, teams one of the creators of Airplane and the Naked Gun movies with the creators of TV's outrageous cartoon comedy South Park. David Bianculli, our TV critic who actually enjoys South Park, saw the film and has this review.
It's not my imagination. The movies, more and more, are turning into giant TV shows. There's already been a big-screen X-Files movie this summer, and a new version of The Avengers is just around the corner. All the summer thrill movies, hot to attract teen audiences, cast heavily from TV shows. So if you don't want to catch the young stars of Dawson's Creek in reruns, you can go to the movies and watch them in new films like Disturbing Behavior. It makes sense because Dawson's Creek was one of the two hottest TV shows among teens last season, and any movie with them in it is likely to draw enough loyal young fans to post a profit. The same logic goes for the year's other hottest show among teens, Comedy Central's irreverent animated series, South Park. Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who provide the scripts and most of the voices for South Park, are considered the impish bad boys of the media right now. South Park is a hit precisely because it's so gross and foul-mouthed and intentionally shocking. Any movie featuring them, therefore, is not intended for and will not please anyone who's easily offended. Technically, Basketball is more of a David Zucker movie than one from the South Park guys. Zucker, one of the zanies who revived movie spoofs with the original Airplane film, not only directs Basketball, but is its co-producer and co-author and based the movie on a hybrid game, part basketball, part baseball, part insult humor, he and his friends invented and played a decade ago. But even though Parker and Stone didn't help write the script, they're the stars and they're clearly the main reason people will go see the movie. At least that was true of the preview screening, where the biggest laugh occurred where Parker, for one brief moment, adopted the same marble-mouthed voice he uses for the character of Cartman on South Park. And as with South Park, much of Basketball is intended to shock, with several scenes that elicit either gasps or groans, and lots of humor that not only hits below the belt, but lives there. Here's a scene in which Yasmin Bleeth, formerly of Baywatch, so there's another TV tie-in, brings Parker's Joe Cooper, a star basketball player, to visit a hospitalized young fan.
Joey? Look who's here.
My biological father?
No, dude, it's me, Joe Cooper.
Coop?
I talked to the people at the Dream Come True Foundation, and they want to make your last wish come true. So what's your dream?
Well, I've always dreamed of big game hunting. How about killing an endangered species, like a bald eagle or a giant panda?
Well, Joey, I don't think that's in the true spirit of the foundation.
Well, then, how about poisoning a reservoir?
I know!
How about throwing flesh-eating fish into a public swimming pool?
I don't think you're quite getting the point, dude.
Come on, Joey. Search your heart. What's the one thing that you want more than anything else in the world?
Chelsea Clinton?
That's a pretty tall order, dude. You'd have a better shot at Bill.
Considering that Parker and Stone are writers and animators, not actors, they handle their movie roles well. Parker, especially, has the looks and confidence to carry off being paired on screen with Bleeth, which is a compliment. But other compliments regarding basketball are harder to generate. The opening narration, which charts the corruption of modern-day major league sports, is clever and sophisticated, but almost everything that follows is silly and sophomoric. Jenny McCarthy, in a supporting role, is so unfunny she approaches the concept of anti-humor. And of the many celebrity cameos, only Bob Costas, Al Michaels, and Ernest Borgnine really register. But my 14-year-old son, who had the good taste not to like Godzilla or Armageddon, liked basketball a lot, laughed loudly in all the proper gross places, and told all his friends to go see it. With this kind of movie, that's the opinion, not mine, that really counts.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Well, Buffalo Bob Smith has died at the age of 80, and his passing is probably inspiring just about every baby boomer in America to remember all the time they spent in front of the TV watching the Howdy Doody show. The show had one of the most famous theme songs in TV history. Trumpeter Lester Bowie reworked the theme on a recording he made in 1981. Let's hear it. Probably all the kids who watched the Howdy Doody show wish they were one of the kids on the set in what was known as the Peanut Gallery. All kids seem to envy the kids who were in the cast of TV shows. Monday, we're going to preview a new documentary from producer Jay Allison's series, Life Stories. It's about Dan Gettleman, who almost became a cast member of the 70s PBS kid show, Zoom. He's gone through life wondering what he missed. We'll hear about it Monday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.